The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
This is Philadelphia's Morning Answer with Chris Stegall on Philadelphia's AM 980, The Answer.
Glad to have you here. It's Friday, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks so much for being here today. Telephone number 610-850-0990, 610-850-0990. We're online at 990theanswer.com on a busy Friday today. I had to dive into this story that I talked to you about off the top yesterday because it's just too delicious. Philadelphia media is mad at a journalistic outpost that's daring to tell the story of murders in our town and why the deaths, the bodies are piling up at the morgue. And they made a sort of contest out of it, encouraging their readers to guess how many Philadelphians would die by the May 18th election. And the Philadelphia journalism community got very mad at this outlet called Philadelphia Weekly. We're going to talk with Ben Manis, who is one of the contributors to Philadelphia Weekly, about this. They have not backed off their position, by the way, that they don't think the Philadelphia media should be nearly as outraged with them as they should be the city of Philadelphia, its lack of leadership, and the DA, Larry Krasner. John Hayward, our pal from Breitbart.com, one of the smartest thinkers I know. He is, particularly when it comes to international affairs, the G7 is going on right now, and John Hayward will be with us at 7:30 to talk about the trip, Kamala's non-border trip. Dr. Jill was making. I'm just sure of it now. I am on to something here. Dr. Jill and Kamala are at odds. You know, Bonchi, our friend Bonchi from Red State, actually believes. I'd be curious to know what you think about this. I am not of this mind. I think this is probably too far. I could be wrong. I don't know how ambitious she is. She doesn't strike me as particularly smart. But Dr. Jill, I don't know how ambitious she is in terms of power. She strikes me as one of those people that kind of likes to hang around power. That's sort of the Biden way in general. They're grifters. They like pocketing coin. They like the trappings of an office. They like the limo rides and the posh stays and the private flights and all that stuff. They like living large off of power. I don't know. I think they're kind of like Obama's that way. I don't know how much they actually like doing stuff. It's a lot easier to be a hanger-on, you know, to be in the entourage than it is to actually be the guy or gal that's responsible for making the money and doing the work. It's a lot easier to be the suck-up or the leech or the barnacle on the bottom of the boat. I think that personifies most of the Biden family. I could be wrong on Dr. Jill. I don't know how ambitious she is about wanting to be president or not. But anyway, Bonchi at Red State thinks that's what it's about. He thinks she actually is eyeing the job and is warring with Kamala that way. I'm not so sure. I think they just want Joe to hang around. I think they imagine that Joe is going to live forever or something. Which, I don't know, maybe they've actually had the real Joe cryogenically frozen. You know, if you go down the rabbit hole of Twitter enough, you can see that there are a number of people that actually believe there are two or three Joe doubles out there. And that he's you see the pictures, I bet. If you spend any time online, people that'll do the, what is going on with Joe's face and head? Look at him here, and now look at him here. I mean, it is noticeable to me during certain speeches, he's squinting, you know, like he's staring into the sun. And other times, he looks like he's been hypnotized by one of those, you know, cartoons where they swing the watch in front of you, and his eyes turn big as saucers. That I've noticed for sure. That and the fact that he's obviously had a tremendous amount of cosmetic surgery to tighten up all of his skin, which is just sort of uncomfortable looking on a man. He's starting to look a lot like Wayne Newton. And, you know, as much as I love the Midnight Idol, that's not a good look. But anyway, John Hayward going to be with us at at 7:30 to talk about the ramifications of this trip to the G7, and particularly Dr. Jill, who's over there making news. Daniel Horowitz, our pal from the Conservative Review podcast, he's senior editor at The Blaze. He has additional information today related to what's called ivermectin, which is another relief drug, much like hydroxychloroquine, that the press largely told you was bunk, was witch doctor stuff, was kookery, quackery. You weren't to talk about it. It was you catch COVID and you either have symptoms or you die with symptoms, and there was nothing we could do until we got to vaccine day to solve it. Well, turns out that's not true. In fact, the White House's former White House under Trump, Peter Navarro, who was one of his biggest trade representatives when it came to China. You know Peter Navarro well. I think he's been on the show here once. Love to get him back, as a matter of fact. We'll work on that fast, Eddie. But Peter Navarro tweeted yesterday. He's put a number to hydroxychloroquine, and it is stunning. And this was something I was hot on yesterday on Twitter. If the Republicans have any common sense about them at all, they're going to start taking out ads right now. They're going to start buying. I'm saying spend the money, buy the ads, tell the stories right now. Don't wait 60 days out from an election. You know, don't drag your feet. Don't lament. Don't whine and complain that the media won't cover these things. You buy the ads and you tell the stories. You guys are sitting on boatloads of money. You go to these rubber chicken dinners. You have these cologne and cufflink Thurston and Lovey Howell fundraisers. There's still plenty of people in the GOP who are traditional donors who can cut a check. I know some now. I know some people right now who could cut a check and fund a month's worth of network television spots. I know some people who are that wealthy. They're not particularly passionate about the day-to-day issues, I'm sorry to say, but they're fabulously wealthy, and they're Republican donors, and very, very much in keeping with the type of people I'm telling you about, cologne and cufflink. You could go to them if you were the head of the GOP and say, hey, could you front some money? We really want to tell the story of all the myths, the lies that were told in the last year about Donald Trump's presidency, particularly as it relates to things like hydroxychloroquine, the Lafayette Square situation where he was accused of clearing it with his stormtroopers when in fact it was actually Miro Bowser and the D.C. police who did that, not Trump. Trump didn't order any of it. Trump didn't even know it was going to happen. The whole thing was a lie, as well as many, many other lies. You could go down the laundry list of all the lies. We need to start telling those stories. Do you mind, Thurston Lovey? Could you cut a check so that we could buy some ad time? And Thurston and Lovey would do so. They need to do this. Peter Navarro puts out a tweet yesterday that was devastating. He said, I was sitting on 60 million doses of hydroxychloroquine ready to go. 60 million. 60 million. And Dr. Fauci and the other established scientists of the time said, no, 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 it was kookery and we're not going to do it. And they ran around talking about how Trump was a kook and everybody was lying about hydroxychloroquine. Never mind that in the early days of this, I think I even shared this with you, we got a call from a listener, if memory serves, in New Jersey, who got very sick early. He was one of the, my wife has an uncle in the Chicagoland area who got very sick very early with COVID. I know of two different early, severely ill COVID cases, personally, who were administered hydroxychloroquine when they got to the hospital, and they came out of it. Now, I had other people say, well, that's anecdotal, and you can't really say for sure hydroxychloroquine did that. No, but I can tell you that I know of two stories where people were given hydroxychloroquine when they were in a very bad way and they ended up pulling out of it. And I know that they're not alone. And I know that now there are studies that have been released a year later that say a 200% improval. 200% people improve when administered high doses of hydroxychloroquine and zinc when they've been put on a ventilator. When they've been put on a ventilator, that's, everybody knows that when you've been put on a ventilator with this COVID thing, that means you're probably on your way out. Ventilator's not good. And now this study is confirming that you have a 200% chance of pulling out of coming off of a ventilator if you're given high doses of hydroxychloroquine and zinc. Yes, scientific peer-reviewed studies are now concluding that. And so Peter Navarro came out yesterday. He said, we were sitting on 60 million doses of this stuff. That could have saved, and this was his math, and he put a number to it, that could have saved 50,000 Americans' lives. 50,000 Americans who were put on ventilators and ultimately died with COVID could have been saved by hydroxychloroquine. That's another ad. That's the kind of story the GOP has to tell. Daniel Horowitz similarly coming along to talk about ivermectin. These are very cheap, inexpensive drugs and therapeutics that were available that could have saved lives, tens of thousands of lives. And the left pilloried Donald Trump, and the left shut down the scientific community. The overlords, the tech overlords, they shut it down. You couldn't put up links about it. You couldn't talk about it. You were called a kook if you talked about it. And now maybe you had a loved one. Maybe you know a friend or someone who could have been administered hydroxychloroquine. And everyone was taught to laugh and scoff and not even discuss it, not even entertain it. Perhaps you or someone you know had COVID and went to a doctor and said, hey, how about hydroxychloroquine? And your medical professional was either shamed out of administering it or dismissed it because Trump suggested it. It's one of the biggest scandals of all time. I mean, this is the kind of thing, folks, that you would see in communist China or Soviet Russia. It's despicable what the media in this country did. And they are, without peer, the most dangerous entity in the United States today. The American news media is the most dangerous entity, the most threatening entity to the republic there is. I'm convinced of it now more than ever before. The best news to come out of the last year was Operation Warp Speed, and we never hear about Operation Warp Speed, do we? And then when a cheap, effective treatment was discovered to bridge the time until we got a vaccine, the Democrat media instead decided to terrify Americans, and they didn't use it, and they shamed people into even entertaining these cheap therapeutics. They weren't used. And Peter Navarro has now put it at costing 50,000 lives. You know, this is Soviet Union stuff. This is Communist China stuff. Speaking of Communist China, they manufactured this virus, a virus not found in nature. And Dr. Fauci was all about that kind of experimentation. And the American media helped bury that story, too. We do not have a media. And so I say to the Republicans, now's the time to purchase ads and teach the American people through paid advertising if need be. But sitting around and hoping for the best is not going to work, Republicans. It's not. There was some good news yesterday on the Republican front, particularly here in Pennsylvania. We will get into it coming up. Telephone number, 610-850-0990. 610-850-0990. We're online at 990theanswer.com.
Mike Gallagher, coming up at 9. Now, more of Philadelphia's Morning Answer with Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's AM 990 and 990theanswer.com.
Hey, good to be with you on a Friday. You made it. And I barely did. And folks, when I say barely, I mean very, very barely. But that's neither here nor there. Not going to complain to you. Telephone number 610-850-0990. 610-850-0990. We're online at 990theanswer.com. Coming up, Ben Maness, our friend at Philadelphia Weekly, Philly Weekly, is a fantastic outlet who has been telling the truth, even if we don't necessarily see politically eye to eye, not Ben, but I mean the organization overall, but they at least... they want to tell the truth about what's going on in Philadelphia. And people that want to tell the truth in Philadelphia are far and few between in media these days. There are only a few trusted sources. Delaware Valley Journal, Broad and Liberty, Philadelphia Weekly. They're still not considered, you know, they're very much new media considering the old guard is still, they've got a pretty firm grasp on who consumes, well, you know, Then there's talk radio. I shouldn't leave us out. I think that's a given, though, given that you're here. But other than talk radio and maybe those three publications, you know, two of which are really brand new in the last couple of years, and Philadelphia Weekly's been around a little longer, but not much longer. There's just not much alternative media. I mean, there are maybe you can maybe fill a hand with alternative media in Philadelphia, meaningful, you know, funded alternative media that where you know you can go collect a professional product from professional media people telling stories. You can't fill two hands. You can barely fill one. That's the sorry state of media in this town. But there are certainly dozens of small, medium, and large outlets in media, television, radio, print, that are all peddling the same lies and covering up the same stories. And they're all challenging now Philadelphia Weekly for daring to shirk their journalism credentials to tell the real story about death in town. So Ben Maness coming up, John Hayward coming up to talk about this G7 summit and the Biden's first trip overseas, Daniel Horowitz at Conservative Review, and at The Blaze, he'll be with us to talk about these therapeutics, which are the biggest scandal of 2020. Might be, and it's hard to rank them, but I think it might be the therapeutics. The therapeutics for COVID that we were lied to about. That is probably the biggest scam going. But anyway, that's all on the way today. 610-850-0990. So a young man in West Virginia, I'm looking at a story here today, receiving this vaccine while looking out over the West Virginia Capitol. He's a 16-year-old, and there's been this white-hot fever by the scientific community and the government to get your kids vaccinated. Looking at this particular story of this 16-year-old, because it's sort of the jumping-off point. Here's this 16-year-old getting the shot, and you're hearing it more and more. Hey, the shot's available now to 12 and up. 12 and up. Get your shot. 12 and up. I mean, the message was so pervasive that even my daughter, my youngest, who is 12, came to us and said, should I get the shot? A lot of my friends are getting the shot. I said, no, you absolutely will not be getting the shot. Neither were your brothers. And, you know, for the record, for what it's worth, your mother and I are not getting the shot either. It's not happening. This, of course, confused my daughter because she's around other friends and other people who are susceptible to social media, constantly telling her that you're a bad person if you don't do it. Well, you're either a bad person or maybe you just don't read. Maybe you are so susceptible to being frightened by the media that you don't take a half a second to maybe investigate, stuff that is still emergency use only approved. But I still do. I mean, call me wacky, but I'm not a guy who says, yes, yes, please, hurry, inject me with stuff you raced to clear. I just don't get excited about it. And until you can make the case that I'm going to be near death's door if I catch COVID, I don't care. I just don't. Like, I'm going to gamble on my health. I'm going to gamble on my immune system every time. I just am. And I know that you can point to historical instances. Well, what about polio, Chris? What would you say? Well, polio is entirely different. And if you go back and you look at the vaccines that were developed for some really crippling mass illnesses, it took years. They're years of development, and they've been used over decades, too, incidentally. Now, I realize there are a lot of people in this audience that went to get the vaccine. My parents all got the vaccine, to be perfectly clear. Most of my friends, people in my life, I'm the minority. I recognize it. But, thankfully, I have people in my life that respect my decision and respect and understand where I come down on this, and I'm not made to feel like some sort of science-denying freak. You know, like we're on some kind of weird, mission to the Hale-Bopp comet, you know, all wearing matching jumpsuits and sneakers and, you know, draping the little silk scarf over our head as we all lay down and drink the potion to ride the comet to planet Hale-Bopp or whatever the hell that, remember that lunatic? That's what this feels like with the vaccine. Do it. Do it. Everyone else is doing it. Time to join us. Do it. Do it. No, I don't want to. And furthermore, I'm definitely not pumping my kids full of it. But I know people I personally know people that just couldn't wait to rush to get their kids to do it. And their kids were so terrified because their parents were such lunatics that their kids were almost insisting their parents drive them to get the damn shot. Well, wait just a second. The CDC now says heart inflammation cases were higher than expected in 16 to 24-year-olds after the second COVID vaccine shot. Now, we stopped administering the J&J shot, the one J&J shot, over, my understanding was, 5 to 6 women who developed a condition of some kind. 5 to 6. Like, it didn't even get into double digits when they halted J&J and said, oh, we better take a look at this. They have cases of over 800 documented that they know of young people who have gotten this shot and their hearts became inflamed. There have been higher than expected number of cases of heart inflammation in 16 to 24-year-olds after receiving second dose of Pfizer and Moderna COVID-19 vaccines. Clearly, there's an imbalance there, says the one of the doctors at the CDC's safety office. Though rare, they can't get this from CNBC. It's rare. Oh, it's very rare. Well, let me tell you something. Here's somebody I'm even more sensitive about than me and my wife. My kids. So we can talk a lot about this vaccine that was raced to market and injecting it at us in we adults. But I get really prickly when you start talking about injecting my kids with something when you've never made the case, by the way. No one in the scientific community has made the case. And until the last couple of months, the propaganda about kids wasn't even really there. There was an overwhelming consensus that kids were not, and in fact, everybody said it. You go back and look. Kids were not even part of this discussion. Kids contracting this, kids spreading this, kids getting very sick or symptomatic. It wasn't a thing. And then all of a sudden, this vaccine came out, and every kid needed to get it, too. Hey, you know, these kids could spread it, too. Well, we're seeing increased... And surprise, surprise, Fauci this week. Oh, yes, we're starting to see very alarming upticks in children. We're starting to see that a certain variant is going to get into kids. Yeah, I'm sure. Like, you know, at some point, with all the lies that we've been told, and we've been told whoppers and a lot of them, you'll forgive my skepticism. I am not in the mood to listen to a single government official tell me about their new discoveries in the last couple of weeks and why it's urgent now that we give the kids the same shot that we've been giving the adults. Even though for the last year, the kids were not the priority because we all knew kids were not getting sick in any meaningful numbers and kids were not even really transmitting the virus or showing symptoms in any meaningful numbers. Now suddenly, oh, you're very curious. The kids, yes, we need to inject the babies. We need to inject the mothers twice. And if they're pregnant women, then we need to inject their wombs. Let's inject pregnant women 6 or 7 times. And if they're twins, each twin gets 5 shots. You get the feeling after a while they're just moving product. That's really what this feels like to me. It's like a fire sale on the vaccine. I don't know. I just find the whole thing gross. I don't like it. Not even a little bit. And I don't care who knows it. And I don't care how crazy that makes me sound to you. I'm not in the mood. I don't trust these people. I don't trust anything anyone says. And I am not going to just lay down and take a shot because somebody orders me to or tells me my kids should. And there's no amount of guilt that's going to be heaped onto me about it. I'd rather be taken away in a box having died from the virus, frankly, than having developed a condition or gotten sick or getting my kids sick or inflaming their hearts with something that was manufactured and injected in them without being studied. I don't know. Call me crazy. I'm just going to roll the dice. But I don't know how you think you're not rolling the dice when you get stuck with something like this. I don't. I'll just be honest with you. I mean, you do you, I'll do me. We'll see who's right, who's wrong. A lot of people, most people aren't even affected by it. But don't talk to me about the science when there's so little we know about this very experimental vaccine.
Hey, it's Sebastian Gorka. Join me this afternoon at 3. Now, more on Philadelphia's Morning Answer with Chris DeGar.
telephone number 610-850-0990. 610-850-0990. We're online at 990theanswer.com. I got a brilliant tweet from, you can see the tweet if you're on Twitter who it's from. But it was a great observation, one that I had not even considered before. What do we hear all the time from the left when it comes to things like guns? If it saves one life. If the legislation saves but one life. They love saying that. They would love to implement whatever they believe is their grand policy and their grand strategy on the left, and foist a policy on all of us. If it saves one life, wasn't it worth it? They love that. Until the stories of rare cases of heart inflammation and sudden death are occurring amongst children ages 16 to 24 from the vaccine, then it's, shut up, you quack, and take the shot. Shut up, lunatic, take the shot. Be a good little soldier and take the shot. Yeah, but kids are dying and their hearts are inflamed. 800 of them. Shut up, you. That's rare. Okay. 610-850-0990, the number. 610-850-0990. You can find us online at 990theanswer.com, where you can stream us there. And by the way, hope you'll check out the daily podcast. I do one there every single day at chrisstegall.com. It's a daily, usually about an hour long, in addition to this show every day. You can catch me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Parler. I'm linked up there. Put our latest YouTube videos, Fox appearances up there at chrisstegall.com. You can also join my email list, which I don't sell. I'll never spam you. I don't do any of that stuff. I just, just my way to connect with you directly. So if you care to email me and let me know directly what's going on your mind, or give me your email address so I can keep in touch with you about what's going on with us, always appreciate it. Go to chrisstegall.com. All right. I'm not sure how much money you'd have to be paid to do what Allison Camerota on CNN had to do yesterday. And I wish we had this audio for you. Unfortunately, we don't. We've had a series of technical problems this week. But this is maybe the most remarkable moment I've ever seen on cable television. And I know that's a bold statement. When I say remarkable, I mean shocking. It is jaw-droppingly shocking. Now, pundits, television pundits, I know because from time to time they call me, they are a dime a dozen. Anybody that can string a couple of words together and put a little powder on their face is suddenly a TV pundit and can be on television talking about some subject of which they're supposedly an expert or have perspective. It's not hard to find people that are willing to do it. Lord knows in my business, people are elbowing one another to do it. There's no shortage of people that would love to go sit on cable news and fill airtime. And there is no shortage of people whose existence is filled with trying to be on and stay on TV. It is what they live for. And I'm telling you, there are just a certain breed of people, and count yourself lucky if you don't know who these people are. I know too many of them. Their existence, their every waking minute of every day is either getting on TV or figuring out how to stay on TV. Because it is an addictive drug for some people to be on television. There is just nothing some people want more than to be recognized for having been on television. They get all of their validation and all of their meaning in life from being on television. And I am so very, very glad, thanks to my relationship with Jesus Christ, that I have absolutely not one drop of that in my blood. Not a drop of it. I'm very grateful and blessed, and I love being here on the radio with you. Do I derive meaning from it? I used to derive much more meaning from it than I used to. I used to derive much more meaning for it than I do now. I love doing it, but I used to be, I will admit, kind of more wrapped up in doing this every day than I am now. It used to be, you know how they say that your job, whatever your job is, whatever your work is, men are particularly bad about this. We identify with our livings. You know, like if we didn't have our job, if we didn't, that's why when we talk about the dignity of work, that is a thing. Dignity of work, having pride in your work, having a sense of purpose, that's a good thing. That's not bad. But there are people whose lives, and you know people like this, whatever it is, they don't have to be broadcasters, they can't seem to extract meaning from their life unless they're working. That's different, and that's not good. And I would say that that's where I was for a good many years before I had sort of an epiphany, a literal come to Jesus, and realized, okay, yeah, I'm missing it. Now I get it. And so I have a much better balance in my head with that now than I ever used to. But these TV people are a rare breed. It is like crack cocaine for the ego, TV. And they will do anything, and I'm telling you, anything to be on TV and stay on TV. Now, on the other side of it, knowing that, executives and people that are in the position to hire people to put them on TV have a very, very deep pool from which to fish to put people on TV to be pundits and commentators, right? So you don't really need to work hard or take too long to find people to come on TV and do analysis on anything, anything. Politics, medicine, the law, you'll always find people who are TV ready to come on and do it. Which brings me to Jeffrey Toobin, CNN's chief legal analyst, who you might remember about 8 months ago, a story came to light. He also wrote for The New Yorker, in addition to doing commentary for legal analysis on CNN. You might remember that old Toobin was on a Zoom call, as so many of us were in this last year of COVID, and he's talking to his colleagues at The New Yorker when suddenly they're looking at the screen and they realize that Jeffrey has his tube in his hand. And he's doing some tubing, if you will. And this is going on a live Zoom call with all of his colleagues in the room. And he's literally, he's in intimate relations with himself on a Zoom call for all to see. And they say, are you, Jeff, are you, we can, is that what you're, are you doing what we think you're doing? Well, naturally, there were many women in the room who were offended. I mean, frankly, if I were a man, I'd be offended. Good Lord. I mean, I'm nothing to look at, but you look at Jeffrey Toobin and you think, first of all, let's just all be clear. Ain't nothing about that part of anybody's anatomy I want to see, no matter how attractive you are. But second, it's Jeffrey Toobin. Ugh. And so everybody looks up at the screen and they see him tubing, if you will, and they say, "You, Jeff, you're on camera." Oh, sorry, am I? Zip. Well, correctly, The New Yorker decided this is probably not something we're going to be able to navigate. I think we're just going to let you go, Jeffrey. Thanks for your time here at The New Yorker, but we're going to end our relationship. And that was that. Now, TV is a different beast. TV, there's something just unbelievable about TV, and I've never worked in it long enough, and I don't know the upper echelons of network TV and cable TV, so I can't tell you the thinking that goes into this. But much like Brian Williams, who was a much less egregious case in many ways, when you're talking about someone pleasuring themselves on a Zoom call, Brian Williams just lied about his time, you know, he got shot down and his heroics, and he was out there covering the war zone, and he was in a helicopter when they took incoming and fire, and he told that story over and over. It was a complete lie. Brian Williams, like Jeffrey Toobin last year, they are banished for 6, 7, 8 months to go think about what they've done and seek counseling and you know, really look inwardly. But amazingly, remarkably, they're brought back. They're brought back and given jobs again. Now, I'm not saying that these people's lives should be ruined. I don't want you to misunderstand. I'm just saying, in the vast pool that I explained there is of people who are TV ready and all too willing to do whatever they must do, I mean, they'd literally murder their whole family to be on TV, do you really have to bring the Stolen Valor guy back to anchor a show on MSNBC? Do you really have to bring back the guy who was tubing in front of colleagues on a Zoom call, and all the world knows about it, and was fired from The New Yorker? Do you really bring him back? Well, in CNN's case, they do. They give Jeffrey Toobin another shot to come back, and what they did yesterday was nothing short of remarkable. They brought in their anchor, and you ladies, in particular, you ladies, I'm talking to you, Because this, I would imagine, would be actionable in this day and age if Allison Camerota were someone who wanted the lawyer up. I want you ladies to imagine being told, I want you to go on cable television before millions of people, and I want you to talk about your colleague Tubin with him and reintroduce him to the audience now that he's been gone for 7 months. I want you to set it up and explain to the audience what he was doing. Ladies, how would you feel about that? How would you feel about being asked to basically be the woman to reintroduce your colleague for having done that and explaining it to the audience so everybody could understand and giving him a platform from which to talk about how he's atoned and he's learned? I frankly, if I'm Allison Camerota, I'd have hired an attorney. I would have said, you find another anchor. I'm not, no thanks. I will not be introducing my pantsless colleague to the audience, trying to give him cover to come back. But that's what they did. And he came back yesterday, and he did about a three-minute monologue with Allison Camerota about how he was pleasuring himself on camera and how he's really thought a lot about it. And he's doing some therapy and some reflection, and he's been working at a food bank to make himself a better person. I'm not making any of that up. It was the most remarkable thing I've ever seen. How bad do people want to be on TV? How bad? So bad that you're willing to, after having been publicly shamed and humiliated for pleasuring yourself on camera, you're willing to come back and tell a nationwide audience of CNN, such that it is, yep, I did. I had my pants down and I was pleasuring myself before my colleagues. And I've gone to therapy and thought long and hard about it. And, well, not long and hard. And I'm so very sorry and grateful to be back here at CNN. How desperate are you at CNN for a legal analyst that's who you go back to? You make one of your other signature anchor people? I run out of ways to tell you how incredulous I am. Incredulity is the only word. I have no way of describing it other than that. 610-850-0990, the number. 610-850-0990. And we're online at 990theanswer.com.
This is Philadelphia's AM 990. The Answer.
So glad to have you here today on this Friday edition of the show. Telephone number 610-850-0990. I believe a gentleman wanted to weigh in on Brian Williams specifically, though his name I've forgotten, Vic. We still got him? Do we want to try to take him? Yeah, probably not. Let's just get through it. Telephone number 610-850-0990. 610-850-0990. Shame on me for thinking beyond what we need to stay focused on today. Listen, I think I am more and more and more inclined to believe that my thesis yesterday was 100% right. Kamala Harris and Dr. Jill are at war. I am 100% sure I know I'm right now. Why do I know? Because The Hill. The Hill, which is sort of the gossip rag for nerds in Washington, D.C., has a new story today that Kamala Harris gets tough reviews over border on first foreign trip. This, as Emerald Robinson, our Newsmax correspondent to the White House, told us yesterday, she pretty much confirmed there is no leaking from the White House. There are no sources from the White House unless this White House wants it to be known. So we know no negative news comes from the Biden administration. There is no such thing as covering or talking about this administration negatively, just like there was no negative coverage to be told about the Barack Obama administration. You just don't do it. It's verboten. It is not allowed. So when you start to read negative reviews about any entity of the Biden administration, it's on purpose. It's been planted, and they've asked. They basically told members of the media, like CNN or The Hill, hey, we need you to ding some people a little bit. And in this case, I think it's Kamala Harris. And I think you have people closest to Grandpa to thank. Before Vice President Harris's plane touched down at Joint Base Andrews after 1 o'clock Wednesday, the narrative of her first foreign trip had already been cast. Biden allies and even some people close to Harris say they viewed her trip to Guatemala and Mexico as a disaster, as one put it. They said they were left wondering why she seemed so ill-prepared to handle basic questions like, why haven't you been to the border, that have been telegraphed by Republicans and conservative media, as well as more mainstream outlets, given her focus on the Northern Triangle countries and immigration. Harris's comments about visiting the border during the trip left almost everyone shaking their heads inside and outside the White House. One longtime Biden ally says it wasn't great, a little cringeworthy too. I don't know how they weren't preparing for these questions. Another ally was blunt. It was terrible. I don't know how else to say it. The allies pointed to several comments that gave critics of Harris and Biden an easy talking point. Uh-oh. So Biden allies are out there mouthing off about Kamala. This continues to aid and lend credibility to my thesis yesterday. This isn't by accident. They're trying to chip away at her credibility. The Biden people are trying to brush her back off the plate a little bit. As I told you yesterday, and as we all understand, Grandpa is not the president. The people behind Grandpa are the president. Grandpa is to shut up, sign documents, read what's on the teleprompter. Dr. Jill, I think, and some Biden associates have other ideas. And I think now that they've got their footing, they're starting to realize, hey, you know, Gramps is still president around here. Why are we just following Obama's orders? This is, you know, it's the classic subplot of every, it's you know what it is? You know what this plot line is? It's Dave. It's the movie Dave with Kevin Kline. Or is it Kevin Kline? Yeah. He plays a stunt, or he plays a body double, like the real president's in a coma, and there's another guy in the country who looks exactly like the real president, who they bring in as a body double so that the public is fooled into thinking that the real president is okay. And behind the scenes, the real president's chief of staff is this devious guy who's decided they're going to use the double of the president to get their way. So they hire this double to just go out and pretend he's the president, but he doesn't have to do any deciding, any leading, because the devious guy behind the scenes is going to, you know, pull all the strings. But then the double they bring in has a heart of gold, and he sees things he wants to fix, and he wants to be the real president, even though he's not. And so the behind-the-scenes conflict is the double for the real president now wants to act as though he's president and assert himself. And the sinister people behind the scenes who have wanted to just use him to get their way, now they're at odds with him. It's a literal movie plot, but I think we're actually watching it play out in real time with Grandpa and Kamala.
You live here. He lives here.
Absolutely love your show.
Thank you very much for your show. It is really something to look forward to when you wake up in the morning.
You've done a terrific job. You've earned my listenership.
Thank you very, very much for your sane reasoning and conversation.
This is Philadelphia's Morning Answer with Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer.
Good to be with you on this Friday. Hope you're looking forward to a good weekend. Telephone. I know my kids were just in orbit yesterday. They finally got through this miserable school year. Finally, all over with. They were all partying yesterday with their friends, sleepovers and whatnot. So yesterday, the official last day of school, and my kids couldn't be more thrilled. Telephone number 610-850-0990. We're online at 990theanswer.com. Pennsylvania yesterday, by the way, finally did something, folks. The Republicans finally did what you told them to do. I couldn't believe the day came. I mean, I don't know if it was because of cajoling from people like you and Guy Shiraki, but our guest yesterday, as we talked about the kind of flat-footed, ineffectual nonsense in Harrisburg, even though you gave them all the backing in the world on May 18th to shut this governor down and end these emergency restrictions, They still weren't acting. They kept coming on shows like mine and saying, well, I'm still got a certified vote. We really can't do much. The governor went to be. Well, finally, they did something. I'll be damned, folks. The Republican legislature, both the House side and the Senate side, got together and passed the damn thing you voted for, ending the governor's emergency declaration yesterday. Hallelujah, praise the Lord. Finally, finally, ladies and gentlemen in Harrisburg, we have a pulse. We have a pulse, folks. The Republican Party found their balls and actually used them yesterday. How about it? So we're thrilled here. 610-850-0990. All right, I told you yesterday about Philadelphia Weekly. And Ben Manis, who is a contributor to Philadelphia Weekly, I'd be honest with you, I don't know a lot about Philadelphia Weekly. I know they hired the great Stu Bykofsky. I know Ben Manis's work. I don't really know organizationally if they have a political bent or philosophy, to be honest with you. I don't know. We know that most media in Philadelphia is purely left-leaning and does nothing but protect, lie, and shill for Democrats and the current miserable leadership in Philadelphia. So anybody that challenges leadership or the conventional wisdom in Philadelphia is a friend of mine, as far as I'm concerned. So Ben Manis and Philadelphia Weekly did something I think really great. It was last month, so I'm a little late to this story, but what caught my attention was the reaction of the traditional, stalwart, trusted media institutions to Philadelphia Weekly and what they did. So we bring Ben back. Mr. Manis, happy Friday. Welcome in.
Hey, Chris. My ears were burning yesterday. How you doing, bud?
Bud, I'm great. I loved this. I'm sorry I missed it, but I tell you what, it's never too late to say congratulations for getting the Philadelphia institutional media so wound up over there at Philadelphia Weekly that they had to issue a joint letter of condemnation. That was pretty funny.
And while I am a proud member of what we're doing at Philadelphia Weekly, I can't take credit for the quote-unquote contest. That was a staff decision. It was kind of a one-off. They were really just seeing.
Let's just rewind and start at the beginning. I don't know. I guess this was in May. This was an editorial?
Yes, no. Late May, they just because of all the ongoing coverage leading up to the primary for DA, and just in general about our murder issue in this city, which is the incredible rise of homicide, even outlying the rest of the country. So while Daniel Outlaw and Jim Kenney will say, oh no, this is a national trend because of COVID, that's ludicrous. Philadelphia had 238 murders this year so far as of this morning. That's a 38% rise on last year's record 499 officially reported, which was the highest since 1990. So when you consider the gravity of the situation, 2013 and 2014 were 246 and 248 murders for the whole year, and we're not even through the first half of the year yet. This is sad, and we decided at the weekly to put out this thing as a contest to see, basically like a county fair contest, guess the murder rate. Guess how many murders, and we'll give you some quote-unquote sweet swag. Basically a giveaway contest, pick the jelly beans in the jar. This resulted in this media backlash about how cruel we are to victims, which doesn't hold water. It only shows that the reporters that are coming out against us, whether it be Mediaite or, the Inquirer, Helen Urbinus, who is, devoid of any thought, original thought in her head, coming after us and saying, well, this was cruel to victims. Well, what about all the other covers we've put out about the rampant corruption and, crime policy that has led to these murders? There's silence on that.
So it's cruel to victims to take a guess for readers to speculate just how dire and how deadly and how bad the city will get. Why is that cruel to victims? It's cruel
because it's making light of murder, in their eyes. But here's the joke. It shows that the true journalism is dead at the Inky in the Daily News. It does. Because, if you're a student of real newspaper journalists from, you know, the good old days, whether that be, you know, Jimmy Breslin in New York or Stu Baikowski, who's now with, you know, The Weekly, or, you know, people like Charlie LaDuff in Detroit. These are people who know how to bring light to a situation, and if that means sarcasm, if that means satire, so be it. Because our mayor and our district attorney are jokes, and they have appointed a police commissioner who is a joke. And the murders are going up and up and up, and nobody seems to care. And when we point it out, oh, Republicans pounce, which is, you know, the whenever someone is caught, whether it be Hunter Biden or, you know, someone at a local level, oh, you guys are pouncing. You're making light of a situation. Sorry, but if you've spent any time in the street, which Helen Urbina's hasn't, whether she goes out and interviews a family, that's great. But she's from Hartford, Connecticut.
Yeah,
and Hartford's not, you think it's not a great town, but
yeah. Do you think she'd spend a minute walking the streets of Kensington and talk to people there? I bet not.
Yeah,
I want to read a little of this letter, Ben. So this is the open letter to Philadelphia Weekly from the journalism community. Some of you listening may not have heard my show yesterday. I spent the better part of the first hour of the show yesterday talking about this. But if you didn't hear this, it's so funny. I won't read it all. I'll skip ahead, but I'm going to give you the meat of it. This is an open letter to Dan McDonough, Jr., chairman and publisher, and Daniel Kingsbury, general manager at Philadelphia Weekly. And they say this, Ben Manis: we as journalists in Philadelphia condemn your contest, urging readers to guess how many murders there will be in our city by Election Day. We find this disgusting. It shows a blatant disregard for the pain and suffering too many Philadelphia families are enduring. From a safe distance, it trivializes what it means to live with this violence. They go on to suggest that because you're such a lily white newsroom, I guess, and they're not, by the way, which is hilarious, but would you do this if it were so many white deaths? You're only doing this because it's black deaths, is their insinuation. Then this is my favorite part. Even if all of that doesn't matter to you, your actions violate the Society of Professional Journalists' Code of Ethics that states, quote, ethical journalism treats sources, subjects, colleagues, and members of the public as human beings deserving of respect. The code also calls on us to show compassion for those who may be affected by news coverage. We understand your publication is purposely defining itself as an alternative to other Philadelphia media, but this isn't about being conservative, no, or holding a different point of view, no. It's about following simple ethical guidelines while doing so. And if you don't consider your company a part of Philadelphia's journalism community, one rooted in ethics, inclusion, diversity, accuracy, and fairness, then let that be known to the public now. Otherwise, we call on your outlet to immediately retract this vile contest and apologize. And it was signed off on by the Inkies and WHYY and WURD Radio and Philly Black News, Metro Philly. So, your reaction, Ben Manis? That's their letter condemning and wagging their finger.
Yeah, first reaction is the owners, you know, we haven't announced our new editor-in-chief yet. The owners should absolutely frame that as a badge of honor. And here's why they should. It is a badge of honor. So first things first, I learned this as a, you know, a Jewish New York 22-year-old who became a cop in Washington, D.C. when Marion Barry was still around. I learned if they pull the race card out on you, you're doing something right. And why? Because why would I have taken the test and moved to Washington from New York if I had a racist bone in my body? You know, this is the point. You're covering the wholesale murder of black and brown people in a city that has a white mayor and a white district attorney who are cloaking themselves in wokeness. And you're calling us racist? Sorry, but you're the racists. The people using the race cards are the racists. Why? Because at the end of the day, it's not people in Chestnut Hill who are dying. And they have to realize this. By candy-coating the actual issue and not even commenting on the actual issues that we've covered, which is Larry Krasner letting out gun violators and drug dealers, you know, every time they commit a crime so that when they escalate to a murder, there's nothing there to stop them. That's the problem. And until they come to grips with that, they can call us whatever they want to call us. But, hey, we've actually brought attention to the problem a little bit. And you know what? That's journalism.
That's it. I am so look, again, I don't know the movers and shakers, the folks you work for. I really don't know, nor do I care. Sincerely, I don't care
either.
About their political ideology. I am so grateful that there is somebody challenging the status quo of these puffed up, phony outrage, fake news guys that all pretend they're the deans of journalism around here. And they're irked that you dare call attention to something that they refuse to. I say good for you, and to Philadelphia Weekly, congratulations on having people like Ben Manis and Stu Bykofsky as part of your team. Ben, thanks a lot for spending time with us on this Friday. I appreciate it.
Anytime, Chris.
Have a great weekend. That's A. Benjamin Manis, contributor to Philadelphia Weekly. And, yeah, as I said, Stu Bykofsky, who's a fantastic journalist, he joined their team. So, yeah, I agree with him. Frame that letter. That is a badge of honor if the puffed-up, phony news of Philadelphia condemns you, wags their finger, and tells you you're unethical. You're doing something really right.
Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer. This is Dennis Prager, middays 1 to 3. Grab a cup of coffee for the ride in. You're listening to Philadelphia's Morning Answer with Chris DeGaulle.
Well, this is big doings. I must tell you, DeSantis and the people of Florida continue to impress. Critical race theory. They're not having it. And I'll tell you something, the Republicans in Harrisburg would do well to take a page from people like DeSantis. Florida Board of Education. Now, I know currently under Herr Wolf, this won't happen. This would be pie in the sky. But Florida Board of Education deciding yesterday to ban critical race theory from the classroom. This, of course, the Marxist notion of oppressed versus oppressor, that if you have a certain skin pigment, you are immediately in one of those two categories. Everything about your life and everything you learn must be viewed through that prism. It's, of course, antithetical to everything that we've aspired to be and achieve and become, and even what our founders wrote in our founding documents, that all men are created equal with certain inalienable rights. And, of course, we have fallen short of that standard throughout our relatively young history, but we have course-corrected in a remarkably short, bloody, hard-fought period of time. And today, we are a nation far, far better for it because of so much bloodshed to course correct on these ideals. And by the way, the hangers-on of the notion that skin color matters more than character were Democrats, all of them, almost exclusively. The organized party of segregation, the organized party of racism in this country has always been Democrats, and it continues today. And they're now trying a new tactic through this Marxist notion of critical race theory, splintering large groups of people into thinking that they have something for which to atone because they're white, or something for which they're owed because they're not white. And that the system is stacked against them, teaching people to hate one another. That's what this does. And I'm sorry to say that it's not just in our schools. It is very much in our churches. It breaks my heart to tell you, as I've told you before, this entered my church this year. A really radical leftist Marxist associate pastor, and a pretty radical. It's on its face, it doesn't seem that radical. But I'll warn you now: if you're somebody in a church, and anybody enters in for a book talk or a book study or a book discussion in your church, be the bridge. That's your toe being dipped in the water in your church of critical race theory. And so I'd guard our houses of worship against it. Wherever you worship, if you start to see that kind of crap entering your church, run from it or denounce it or pounce on it and beat it into submission quickly, because you don't want it to metastasize. I watched members of my congregation stand before us and talk about what rotten racists they were and how they never understood how privileged and racial and racist, and it was just disgusting. It was the most disappointing, embarrassing. Even my teenage sons looked at me without comment. I did not say a word to them as we sat through this presentation in our church. And their exact take on it as teenage boys was they were embarrassed by the grown men who stood up there and self-flagellated about how racist they were. They said, Dad, it's like that guy was almost made to say that. He didn't even look like he really believed what he was saying. I was embarrassed for them. It's shameful. It is disgraceful. It's disgusting. These white guilt people who think they've got something to apologize for simply because they were born a skin tone. And they're being fed this in our churches now, not just our schools. Now, there's very little that our legislators can do, obviously. Nothing really they can do about our churches. But our schools, they certainly can. And the Florida Board of Education decided yesterday to ban this crap from the classroom. Quote, Florida's education system exists to create opportunity for our children. Critical race theory teaches kids to hate our country and hate each other. It is state-sanctioned racism and has no place in Florida schools. I think everybody should be on record about it. I think our preachers, our teachers, our elected leaders, everyone should be on record on this issue. Because if you think, and I know right now, wherever you listen to me, you may think to yourself, it can't come here, it won't happen here, we've got a great school board, we're a pretty conservative community. Nah, Chris, I live out here in Lancaster County, Berks County, we're good, it can't come here. I'm warning you. Let me be your canary in the coal mine. I never thought I'd see it, not where I lived. I couldn't move far west enough from Philadelphia to try to make sure that I walled myself off and my family off from that stuff, thinking that the politics of Philadelphia couldn't possibly seep this far west. Oh, they've seeped, and they keep seeping. And there's always one or two well-meaning whites in just about every school district across the country, be it rural or urban or suburban. If it hasn't been introduced yet, it's coming because it's in vogue. It's very chic. It's very fashionable. So I'm talking about this is the kind of stuff, you know, running for your school board right now, paying attention to what your school board is doing has never been more critical. And COVID sort of led the way, but COVID was just an imprimatur. Because this critical race theory thing is right behind it, hot on its tail. And it's spreading like a cancer. So all of your elected leaders, all of your sanctioned leaders in our institutions, in our communities, they need to be held to account on this. They need to be, pressed, feet to the fire. Where do you stand on this notion of dividing this community or this congregation or this school, or this district? Where do you stand on the idea of viewing everybody through the prism of their skin color first? I need to know right now. I want to make sure that doesn't happen here. And if it does, I want to disabuse you of the notion that you're going to get away with that here quickly. That's the way we need to start thinking about these people. You can't sit back and just assume and trust, it's probably not going to come here. It comes. Trust me when I tell you. Like Jeffrey Toobin, it comes. Host of the Republican-led state legislature, around the country has been working to ban critical race theory, which seeks to examine history and law through the lens of race. Critics of critical race theory reject the notion that the theory proposes that America's founding was built on racism. Well, of course they do. Why would they be honest with you about what it does? Proponents of the theory say America's founding and institutions today are inherently racist. Well, you just contradicted yourself. I'm reading from The Hill here. I love how they say that. We dispel any notion that this is teaching about systemic racism. But then they say proponents of the theory say America's founding institutions are inherently racist. Anyway, Ron DeSantis yesterday, governor of Florida, says the woke class wants to teach kids to hate each other rather than teach them how to read, but we will not let them bring this nonsense ideology into Florida schools. As the governor of Florida, I love this state. I love my country. I find it unthinkable that there are people in positions of leadership in the federal government who believe we should teach kids to hate our country. We will not stand for it here in Florida. I'm proud that we are taking action today to ensure our state continues to have the greatest education system in the nation. Wouldn't it be wonderful to have a governor like this? Wouldn't it be remarkable to hear one prominent Republican in Pennsylvania or New Jersey talk like this? Wouldn't it be? They don't. I know we have them. I know they exist. I talk to them all the time. You're that person. You listen. We always get these kind of milquetoast, you know, go along to get along, passionless dullards. We tried, but we have a stiff opposition from it's not the way I would do it, certainly, but I'm... Ron DeSantis, so clear, so bold, so, you know, no pale pastels, just bold, solid colors. This is what we're doing. This is what we're not doing. Here's how it's going to work here. Saying it, declaring it. That's leadership. My God, are we missing leadership in this Commonwealth and in the Garden State, you guys. I don't even have to tell you.
Philadelphia's Morning Answer is streaming live on 990theanswer.com.
Proving that everything is a show with this administration, Dr. Jill put on another one yesterday. It always seems that when there's times of trouble out there, Dr. Jill is dispatched to pull some kind of visual trick out of her hat. I was thinking about this yesterday when I saw the latest event with Dr. Jill where she's wearing a love jacket. Now, the minute I saw this, I knew exactly what this was about. I knew exactly what they were doing. I knew exactly what they were going to do. I knew exactly what they wanted to invoke. She came out yesterday. She and Grandpa traveled to the G7. And she, of course, because he doesn't, she came out to speak to the press because, you know, the press wants to know what the First Lady thinks about international diplomacy. You know, all the great first ladies that have come out and spoken about international diplomacy while their husbands, the president, don't say anything. So she comes out yesterday, and she twirls around. Mrs. Biden, turn around. Let us see your jacket. And she turns around, and it says love across the back of it. Hey, Mrs. Biden, first lady, what does love across your jacket mean? What's that mean? Tell us what you're saying. Oh, I just want the world to love. I want to buy the world a Coke, and I saw that, and I knew exactly what this was. And they're doing it. They're even doing it on Fox. The split-screen photo of what? Remember? That's right, Melania. Donald Trump's wife, the former First Lady, Melania Trump, during the, I can't remember which hurricane or flood. Was it the Houston floods? I don't remember. She wore some, you know, and there's nobody more stylish than Melania Trump. I mean, she literally comes off the runway. She was wearing some jacket that said, I don't care, do you? I don't really care, do you? It looked like it was spray painted on the back of the jacket. And, of course, everybody said that was her subconscious. That was her way of subliminally saying to the American people, F you, I don't care. I'm a kept woman, and I hate Trump, and I hate this country as much as you do, and I'm privileged, and I don't care about anybody's struggles. But Dr. Jill wore a jacket that said love. And she wants the whole world to come together and love. Oh, my gosh. This brought to mind when Dr. Jill was sent across the street to give muffins and cookies to the National Guard who'd been brought in to protect the Capitol during the insurrection. Or when she put the giant candy hearts on the lawn to promote the vaccine on Valentine's Day. Dr. Jill is quite the show horse, and she knows showmanship, just like Team Obama before her. They were all about that, the people in white lab coats behind them. They were always selling things with visuals. I mean, Trump was a visual guy, but he wasn't Trump. Well, let's bring in John Hayward, my friend Doc Zero on Twitter. He is a writer and contributor at Breitbart. John, you know this stuff better than anybody, which is why we call you one of the smartest minds out there. What do you make of Dr. Jill here? Good morning.
Well, good morning. You know, I go back and forth between thinking that this stuff is so infantile and stupid, and then thinking, you know, it seems like it kind of works. You know, at least it works well enough to where they keep doing it. Like you said, Obama and the doctors in the lab coats, many of whom turned out to not be doctors. It's always a lie with these people, you know. They can't even do it honestly. But they put on these ridiculous dog and pony shows, and they know the media will just fawn over them, will take them at face value, will just collapse into quivering puddles of goo at the sight of whatever show the Democrats decide to put on. on, you know, the Love Jacket, and they had a heart attack. They swooned, you know, they collapsed in a heap and panted helplessly at the sight of her. This is not even a new jacket. I saw one journalist saying, like, she's been wearing that jacket for 3 years. Why is everybody, like, suddenly acting like it's brand new? But, you know, they'll do that for her. But when it's a Republican, oh, well, you know, Melania Trump, do you remember any coverage of her that was favorable ever? Do you remember anybody in the media ever being impressed by her or even remarking on her sense of style or her fashion or anything, let alone any policy situation or her personality? Of course not. You know, the difference here is that the Democrats know that when they put on one of these stupid first-grade performances, the media is going to act like it's revelatory, like it's the most amazing thing they've ever seen. They know they have a willing audience. If you're a Republican and you try to do anything like this at all, they're going to rip you to pieces. They're going to start finding out. They'll know in 10 seconds flat that guy wearing a lab coat is not a real doctor. And the day after that, everybody in America will know about that guy in the library books he took out 20 years ago.
What do you make of the photo? I don't want to spend a ton of time, although I know I am, but I do find it an interesting story because I think here's my proposition. These leaked pieces from The Hill and others, these leaked testimonies from the White House, insiders, very flummoxed by Kamala Harris's performance in Guatemala, very flummoxed by her inability to speak off the cuff about the border, even though she's supposedly in charge of the border. Biden insiders, Biden aides, very concerned about Kamala. This stuff does not happen by accident with Democrat media and a Democrat White House. The White House wants people to be writing this about Kamala, so why? And then I throw in, just for good measure, here's how I tied it up. Dr. Jill at the desk on Air Force One prepping for the G7 photo. I think there's a there. You?
Yeah, and you remember when that picture you're talking about was released? It was released on a social media account that identified her as a government official, a U.S. government official, Jill Biden, the first lady. You know, I guess she's the minister of baking cookies or whatever. I mean, it's so ridiculous. And yeah, it really does seem like there's something going on here, and it's got to be a factional fight. You know, everyone knows, well, let's be honest, everyone knows Joe Biden is basically a meat puppet. You know, he doesn't know what he's doing. He barely knows where he is. He's a figurehead, and there are people running him. There are shadowy figures you don't get to see that are actually making all the decisions for this country and doing things. And this sounds like a factional fight between those shadowy figures. And some of them apparently are not happy with Kamala's performance, and they're worried about what happens if Joe doesn't make it to 2024 and she has to take over, and then what are they supposed to do, because she's a disaster. But you know, they and the voters should have known that going in. I'm not flummoxed by this at all. I knew what she was like.
Yeah, and so at the end of the day, we gotta know, right? Her favorability's not rising. See, this is the thing. I don't necessarily see the off ramp. I mean, we know the media is partisan and in the tank for them, and they'll excuse and do whatever they gotta do, but like, Kamala's not gonna get more popular. So Joe's going to have to stay alive and cognitive for another 6-7 years, or what are they going to do? I'm not convinced it's going to be her. How can it be her unless they can figure out a way to just rig the system entirely in perpetuity?
Well, and they're working on that very hard, so yes. Maybe that is all it will take, and they can run a ham sandwich or over Kamala Harris, and it won't matter, and, you know, they'll have the machinery in place to win anyway. But if they do have to fight a serious presidential battle, and she winds up being at the top of the ticket, they're not going to be in a happy place. And maybe some of what you're seeing now is the beginning of these shadowy figures, these people that are really running America right now. Maybe some of those people are starting to look for an exit ramp for her, a way to ease her out, and maybe bring somebody else into the campaign. Like, maybe if Joe Biden can't run in 2024, how about that noted public government official, his wife, Jill Biden, the avatar of love? You know, maybe she might just make a good candidate.
The avatar of love. That's a great working title if you want to crank out a book, John. I'll give it a loving review on the back if you want to write it. Okay, so the G7 itself, What meaningful role has our president to play in it? I mean, I find it odd that the most that we've heard about it is from his wife, not him.
I know, and look at the media coverage. The U.S. media, anyway, is covering this like some incredible, stunning success. Like, they can scarcely believe that being unbelievable, sacred thing that they're watching here is Joe Biden. America is back, and Joe Biden is striding across the world like a colossus. Well, that's not how the foreign media are reporting it. You know, if you read the actual, like, British papers and whatnot, they think he's a boob. Like, they don't think any of this is going well for him at all. They can't understand why Biden himself isn't making public appearances. They're not too impressed impressed with anything about his agenda, really. And the only thing that they're super concerned with in the immediate future is the Iran nuclear deal. They want the Iranian money. The Europeans always have. They're all bought off. And they want to keep that Iranian money flowing. So they want the nuclear deal back. And Joe Biden certainly wants to get back into the Iran nuclear deal. Him and his handlers are 100% on board with that. But they can't, because Iran is awful. Iran keeps making it impossible for these people to get the Iranian nuclear deal going again. And I think there's a little disgruntlement at the G7 among these other nations that Biden can't deliver on that. And it's not entirely his fault. You know, the Iranians are making it impossible for the U.S. to get back in the deal. But they thought that whole nuclear deal thing was going to happen a lot faster and go a lot smoother. And they're not happy that it isn't.
John, may I hold you over for a break? Do you have time?
Sure.
Okay, thank you. John Hayward's with us, Breitbart.com, Doc Zero on Twitter. If you want to follow and read all of his tweets, you should, because everything that comes from him is always insightful and brilliant, as you're hearing right now. Because I got to ask him about some critical race theory. His home state, Florida, Governor DeSantis. I want to ask him, too, about the news this week on hydroxychloroquine and Lafayette Park and more of these phony news stories that have all been debunked. That's on the way with John Hayward. Quick break here. 610-850-0990 is our telephone number on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer.
News, opinion, passion. Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer.
Still to come. Just after the news at 8 o'clock, Daniel Horowitz will be with us. He's the host of the Conservative Review podcast. Daniel is, he's saying the censorship of not just hydroxychloroquine, but another drug out there on the open market that was largely kept to themselves and kept under wraps and told you were kook for talking about, ivermectin. He says that's one of the biggest scandals that you weren't told about in the last year, these therapeutics. Back with John Hayward at Breitbart.com. He's Doc Zero on Twitter. So, John, the stories of Lafayette Park or Lafayette Square, and, you know, we were told last year that Trump cleared it with his stormtroopers so that he could go have a photo op with a Bible. Turned out not to be true. It was the D.C. police, Muriel Bowser's police, who used the pepper spray and cleared the park. Trump had nothing to do with any of it. Nobody knew anything of it. In fact, the Interior Department, the government arm under the executive branch, dissuaded them from doing what the D.C. police ultimately did. How detrimental, I guess my question is, how detrimental, how meaningful do you think stories like these, as well as hydroxychloroquine and the president being called a kook all last year, now we know 200% increase in lives saved on ventilators by using high doses of hydroxychloroquine, new studies show. These stories made Donald Trump look as bad as any last year. How detrimental were they? How helpful were they to Democrats?
Well, and let's toss another big one on the pile, the lab leak hypothesis of the coronavirus being released. We were told that only Trump was an idiot for bringing that up, and it was debunked and discredited, and Tom Cotton and anybody else that brought it up was a wild-eyed conspiracy theorist. And then a year later, with Joe Biden safely in the White House, the media says, Oh, wow. Oh, my gosh. You know what? It's actually a real theory, and it probably is what happened. Oh, wow. Golly gee to Willikers. Let's talk about that now. I mean, again, this stuff is so stupid, you know, that I can't believe people fall for it. But I have to stress that in all of these stories that we're talking about, this was not just the media making a mistake. They didn't just get it wrong. They lied to you. On purpose. They knew what the truth was. They knew what happened at Lafayette Park. This wasn't like Indiana Jones finding the lost ark. You know, it wasn't some grand adventure and they finally got to the bottom of the truth of this twisty, complicated story. It wasn't like solving the JFK assassination. This was obvious from minute one what happened in Lafayette Park. It was clear, and the media could have told you the truth. They deliberately chose to lie to you. They deliberately lied to you about lab leak. They knew it was plausible. They knew why people that were saying it wasn't plausible were doing that. They knew that the debunking, quote unquote, was one letter from like six or seven people that had interests in the Wuhan Virology Laboratory, financial interests, you know, that were just trying to, when they put out those letters, they knew all of that. They lied to you. And with hydroxychloroquine, they got people killed. The media and the Democratic Party's political rhetoric killed people with hydroxychloroquine, pure and simple.
And in terms of its impact on the election and the electorate, do you think it, I mean, and again, I think there's so much wrong with the November election. How culpable was the media in turning the outcome of this election, in your view? How effective are they? And by the way, here's another working thesis I suggest to Democrat or to Republicans, rather. You're not going to depend on the media to get it right or tell the truth, so you're going to have to buy ads to go around them, and it probably needs to start now, telling the truth about what these stories really are, and it may cost you money to buy ads to do it, but that may be that may need to happen. I mean, how real is this in terms of its impact on elections, this out-and-out media fraud?
It was enormous because this election, I mean, the president, the incumbent president, was going into a tough race here because of the year of the coronavirus. Anybody would have a hard time running after dealing with something like that. And President Trump's style had created some political openings. You know, there are people who just didn't like him and weren't going to vote for him, whatever. Some people love him. You know, it was contentious going into the election. And in that landscape, the media's biases, the way that they told the story, the way they framed the narratives, the way they always wrote every story to make Trump look as bad as possible, you put that together with the mail-in ballot hijinks, you know, the hinky stuff that happened with mail-in ballots, the magical mystery votes after midnight, and then you add that to the titanic amounts of money that were spent by people, these stories that are coming out of these left-wing billionaires spending hundreds of millions of dollars on electioneering activities to get rid of Trump. All of that together is what made the election so hard for him to win, and he still got awfully close. I mean, that's the amazing thing to me, that he came as close as he did with all of that artillery lined up against him. That's pretty astonishing. But there's no question that with a fair media, it would have been very difficult for Biden to win that race, even with all the mail-in ballot hijinks and all the money. The media was decisive.
A couple of more funny, interesting, sad, I don't know what you want to call them. They're not particularly politically meaningful per se, or maybe they should be. I don't know. I'd love to get your take on it. The Hunter Biden disclosure this week that he, you know, used the N-word a lot in text with his lawyer. I actually found it more telling and interesting that he mocked the notion of God, called it an imaginary fiction of people that are collectively scared, which is actually just the opposite. But never mind that. It's a character thing. We know the guy's a mess and a disaster. Should it be more important politically, or is it just a prurient story?
Well, if it was Donald Trump Jr., it would be the biggest story on the planet. No question about it. Still would be. It would be the biggest story on the planet 2 months from now if any of this was Donald Trump Jr.'s emails. You know, they would never give it up, ever. Even if it wasn't Trump in office anymore, they would never give it up. And what I think you're going to see with Hunter Biden's story, it looks like they're choking it to death. The media's burning it, and they're keeping it from becoming any kind of a big story, so there's no buzz over it. But if it breaks out of that media stranglehold and it starts getting widespread play and it really does start causing problems, they're going to turn around and say that this is your fault. You, Mr. and Miss America, you, the people listening to this radio station, you did this. You're at fault for Hunter Biden's sins because America is systemically racist. And even poor Hunter Biden, a son of the noble Biden family, the avatars of love, because his mom is the goddess of love, and here's this noble royal family, and you people have made Hunter Biden use this racist language because America is systemically racist, and even a noble soul like Hunter Biden can fall prey to inherent racism. Get ready for that. That's going to be the spin if they don't manage to suffocate the story under the pillow.
And then the Jeffrey Toobin story. I talked about this earlier this morning. How badly do you want to be on TV? How craven are you for a career in television that you would be willing to come back and sit down at the desk with a colleague and openly discuss you pleasuring yourself on a Zoom call for which you've been fired from one job and sidelined for 7 months? I mean, I the ego in someone, I can't even really begin. It's almost pathological or it's like a sociopath or something. I you would think that would be enough for a guy like Toobin to go away. But no. He proudly sat there on the desk at CNN and bore it all again to the American public. Yep, I'm a chronic masturbator. Very weird.
And they did it with a female anchor interviewing him, and they made her tell the story of what happened to him.
Oh.
I mean, I don't know what happens to you when you go to work for CNN. How do you check out that much of your dignity and self-respect that you're willing to participate in this? And what news network would bring him back? I mean, to some extent, when you're talking about someone in Jeffrey Toobin's position, isn't your job basically based on your judgment? You know, your ability to analyze news events, your ability to make judgment calls about the news of the day. Well, it seems like, you know, getting caught doing what he did is a pretty catastrophic error in judgment. And I don't know how you bring somebody like that back and say, all right, he's been in timeout for for 6 months. That's long enough. He's back and ready to resume his career. Right? It's just mind-boggling.
Oh my God! I mean, there's not like there's not a dearth of you know there's not a dearth of you know legal analysts and pundits ready to go on television. Lord knows, you the best you could do was Jeffrey Toobin. John Hayward is Doc Zero on Twitter. He's at Breitbart.com. Read everything he writes. Thanks for your time on this Friday, sir.
Thanks very much for having me.
You live here. He lives here.
You are a role model for the rest of the media. You really do investigative reporting and informative interviews.
I absolutely love your show.
Good morning, sir, and thank you for everything you do.
This is Philadelphia's Morning Answer with Chris Stegall on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer.
You know, I kind of tend to agree with Bethany Mandel. She is a contributor to Ricochet. She tweeted this yesterday. If you gave me a choice between giving up my entire career, if you gave me a choice between giving up my entire career and going on TV to explain how and why I pleasured myself on Zoom, I cleaned that up, by the way. If you gave me a choice between giving up my entire career and going on TV to explain how and why I pleasured myself on Zoom, just buy me a housewarming present for my cabin in the mountains because that's where you'd find me for the next 30 years. That's exactly right. Of course, she's exactly right. We're talking about, if you're just joining us, good morning. It's Friday. Welcome in. Welcome to the kickoff to the weekend. And that music, we just enjoy it every now and again. Like to throw it in there for good measure. We're going to keep doing it throughout the segment. I kind of like that. It's very mysterious. 610-850-0990, the number. 610-850-0990. We're online at 990theanswer.com. Just having a little fun, Vic. You're doing great. Victoria at the helm today. She is fantastic. She has been such a warrior this week. And Steve and Fast Eddie. If you had any idea, again, not gonna whine about it, not gonna bother you with it. Just telling you, if you had any idea what we're going through to pull this thing off this week, I think you'd want to buy us all dinner. That's all. Anyway, come on in if you'd like. 610-850-0990. I just saw this story on Tom Cotton. He's the latest yet again to be sounding the alarm. There's now whistleblowers inside the military who are coming forward to say that anti-American indoctrination is being forced on them. Hundreds of whistleblowers inside the military are saying so. So whether it's inside the military, whether it's inside your house of worship, whether it's inside your school, they're coming hard and fast. I mean, it's sorry again to do this in the same segment as Jeffrey Toobin, but what I'm saying is this is real. These forces, I mean, it's like the hounds of hell have been unleashed in the last 6 months since Trump was vanquished. And it's a very real concern. And somebody who I know thinks deeply about this and many, many other issues is Daniel Horowitz, the host of the Conservative Review podcast. He's senior editor at The Blaze, and he's back with us. Daniel, thanks for your time this morning. Hi.
Hey, great to be with you this morning.
Am I incorrect that it does feel institutionally, just wherever you turn, like something, like there's been a, it's always been there. There's always been a corrosive element from the left, but this feels almost supernaturally sped up. It's intense and it's fast, like a fire hydrant.
Look, yeah, I think you're right. There's always been politics in politics, but we've never really been a nation of laws. We've always been a nation of political will. But now it's just you see it more evidently. There is no law or science. It's all political will. And there's only one side that, for the most part, appears to have that will. And they will something and say, we come, we see, we conquer. This is what we want. This is what we're going to get. You know, as I'm talking to you, there's we've seen this a number of times the last 15 months. But if you recall, and I'm sure you've talked about it on your show, the Cleveland Clinic study that showed not a single reinfection of those previously infected with SARS-CoV-2 in their entire system, and they demonstrated that there is a greater degree of immunity from natural infection than from the vaccine. They now, a couple of minutes ago, put out a statement, kind of like a Al-Qaeda hostage tape type of deal, where they're like, well, we're still telling anyone who is eligible to get the vaccine, make sure you get the vaccine. And, you know, it just shows it's such a joke. We saw this with the Danish mask study. when you actually study something and they get the result they don't like, they have to change it. Everything is rigged.
What is it, Daniel? What is if I could specifically ask on the mask thing, on the vaccine thing, on, I know you want to talk about ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine, these things that are antithetical to what the establishment scientific community or the establishment government wants us to do, they won't hear it. And what is the motive behind it? Is it strictly profit? Or something more?
You know, the CDC is the Center for Deception and Control. So it's deception and control. It's money, greed, and power. They all tie together. And I think what we really learned here is, look, there's nothing right or left. You know, when you say guns, life, low taxes, you know, sovereignty, low crime, I guess even that's political now. But there's nothing political about early therapeutics. You know, if anything, the left claims to be so scared of COVID, you know, we're the ones trying to say, hey, let's go treat it with stuff that's been proven cheap and effective and very much available, very much could be used early on. Natural infection, you know, children aren't at risk. All of these things, there's nothing right or left about them. It has nothing to do with ideology, but yet it's become that way because, again, the system wanted that. And it's very simple if you think about it. You see, if the word got out to people that children and young adults are completely off the table, and then those who are previously infected completely off the table. Well, I mean, 40% of people have gotten the virus. You know, you add children and others to it, and you're automatically going to lose 60-70% of the market share of the vaccine. And then you add to that, you know, you take hydroxychloroquine or ivermectin at the first sign of tingling in your throat, certainly a positive test, and then there's numerous other early therapeutics that the few brave doctors that have actually tried to study this virus and treat it have discovered to work very well to reverse the inflammatory or preempt the inflammatory effects. Well, then their whole ball game's over because then people no longer fear the virus, right? If you you're scared to walk into a hornet's nest, but if you're wearing a suit of, you know, a protective suit, then you're no longer afraid of it. And they need people to be afraid so A, they can control them with all of the fascism, and B, there is enough market share for their edicts. You know, Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, that's what's funding the ads on Google against ivermectin. They literally put on their website that Bill Gates's foundation started them with a $750 million grant in 1999 to shape the vaccine market. That is their word. I think it's very accurate.
And on this, Daniel, and I'm sorry, we've got some pretty, I don't know how noisy it is on your end, but it sounds a little weird on mine. But I'm so sorry about the interference there. But on the marketing and the pushing of the vaccine, I mean, there are people, of course, you know, who think all kinds of things about the vaccine and what's in it and what might be behind it and who's behind it. And I don't want to entertain every single theory, but just generally speaking, is it profit motivated? Is that easy enough to understand that it's just let's move as much product as possible to put coin in our pocket? Is that the simplest thing, or is it more? Is it something more sinister?
Well, I think, like I said, it's mixed with the government control, because if you say that everyone's at risk all the time, even if you got it, even if you're a kid, then people are fearful and there's still a pretext to control people. But I do think the evidence from the last few months shows the profit really is a big deal, because if you look at the way they're lying now, it's all geared towards the vaccine. It's
yes.
Unbelievable. Even the mask thing, which was an idolatry, they let go to the point of leveraging it against the vaccine. Hence, if you are vaccinated, you could take it off. You know, CDC just doctored on their website the language that they had for over a year about the threat of COVID to children relative to the flu. Until now, they had language saying blatantly that it's less of a threat to children than the flu. They changed it and they said under 5. And then they said some kids could still get a serious case, made up, completely made up. Now, why did they say 5? Because from 5 to 17 is what they're working on. They already approved it for 12 and now working on 5 to 12. It's exactly that. Again, why are they obsessively blocking any information on natural immunity? Well, because that takes away 40% of their market share. Why are they obsessively going after any, it's not just one early therapeutic, any treatment? You're not allowed to treat this virus at all. You could do everything for the virus except for actually treat it. Because, again, it's all about the vaccine. It truly is unbelievable. And I'll be honest with you, even a few months ago, I didn't think our government was that malfeasant that they would literally shove a vaccine on people knowing there were that many problems. But I think what's come out over the last number of weeks, it's clear as day that if they had any shred of honesty, they'd say, look, you know, maybe there's still some benefit to some people, but we really need to be circumspect about this. Let's try to do a better job. No, it's like, shut up, no liability, you better get it, but you can't sue anyone for it. And maybe next week we'll hold an emergency meeting on myocarditis, but until then, you better get it. I mean, when have we ever done that in history? We now have a government that is purposely willing to engage in genocide in pursuit of their political, economic, and crony agenda.
Daniel Horowitz is the Conservative Review podcast host and senior editor at The Blaze. The therapeutics story is one of the more scandalous, as you've written, and we just talked a little bit about. The hydroxychloroquine in particular was one that Peter Navarro of the White House, Trump administration, tweeted yesterday. He put a number to it, and I know you're a warrior when it comes to messaging. This is the kind of thing I think Republicans ought to embrace and actually maybe even buy ads to go around the media and start telling stories right now. Navarro puts the number at 50,000 lives that could have been saved if he'd been allowed, if the White House had been allowed to dispatch broadly the, he says, 60 million doses of hydroxychloroquine they had at their disposal. But that was so shut down and mocked and ridiculed and canceled that by the end of the last year, hydroxychloroquine was a punchline. But now studies say we could have saved 50,000 lives, says Navarro. That's a big deal.
Oh, that's a very big deal. And again, broadly with the therapeutics of Dr. Peter McCullough estimates, we could have saved 80% of the casualties. Because again, the big problem is the inflammatory response, not so much the virus, but in people that have low vitamin D levels, low zinc levels, which that in itself is important. You know, everyone should be, if they're really scared of the virus, they've had 15 months to take blood tests, see where their levels are, see how much supplementation they need to take. And yet they refuse to even talk about that, which is shocking. But the reality is that that stuff is very cheap. You know, it's worked. And here's the deal. Like, you know, the mRNAs are very experimental, whereas this stuff has been used for rheumatoid arthritis, scabies, in the case of ivermectin, lupus, and no one's ever had a problem. So, you know what I mean? Once it's used for other stuff, it's not like you're going to have side effects if you use it for something else. The question is just efficacy, and it's been proven effective. And again, I want to stress, it's not a matter of one silver bullet. What the few doctors that have worked on this will tell you, it's like anything else. It's a cocktail. There's a few things. So every doctor should have been trained by April, certainly May of last year. Hey, here are the signs. Here's the way it works. It's cytokine storm. And here's how you treat it. Instead, it was like, shut up, wear a mask, and don't get it. But inevitably, when you do get it, don't do anything until you can't breathe, and then it's too late. And then we have some remdesivir for $3,000 a pop that doesn't work, and a ventilator. And
yeah,
it was, you know, I think Republicans should have embraced that messaging, because the problem is people did fear the virus, because to be fair, for some people, they really did get a rough go at it. And now we know it is synthetically modified. There were some problems with it. Still, most people didn't get it bad, but some people did, and people feared it. And this was the way to deal with it. I was pushing legislation since January when the state legislatures were open to make it very clear that this is a proper protocol, that there shouldn't be any punitive actions taken against doctors or pharmacies who prescribe. And I do think that Representative Don Kiefer, I believe from the York area in your state,
yes,
did introduce a bill like that. I think she showed me the language of it. I don't know what the bill number is, but that is something that I think it's not too late to put out there. Because remember that you know, this virus is going to percolate to a certain extent indefinitely, at least at low levels. And let me tell you something. It's not just this virus. What we've discovered from this is that we've been lied to by Big Pharma over the years that, oh, it's only bacteria you could treat. But a virus, there's no treatment. That's not true. There are numerous ways to – there's numerous cheap therapeutics that have antiviral and anti-inflammatory qualities to it, and that's what's been discovered. And now I think there's a lot of benefits to mono, even the flu. There's a lot of things we've learned from this, so this is something that should definitely be pushed going forward.
Daniel Horowitz is at Conservative Review, the Conservative Review podcast, I should say, and senior editor at The Blaze. I know you follow politics here in Pennsylvania closely, and finally, the people of Pennsylvania had their vote last month, and the Republicans finally found a pulse and did something. They passed and shut down the governor's emergency orders yesterday. It's done, finally.
Well, I
just thought maybe you would be pleased about that, is all.
No, and it's good. Look, it's better late than never. I don't understand why the legislature didn't convene a year ago and do this, and certainly in January, February. But okay, it's better late than never. But again, you know, I don't mean to be cynical, but the proof is in the pudding. When you're late to the game,
correct,
you have to be extra fervent about what you're doing.
That's
so,
right.
You know. In other words, whenever we need a 5, they're at a 2. When we need a 10, they're at a 5. In other words, at this point, it's not good enough to do that. At this point, we need a vaccine, an inoculation against future fascism. And they're already saying they're going to do this for the flu. This is the new baseline. We need a never-again legislation that permanently enshrines in the Pennsylvania Constitution the right to bodily integrity. I've written a piece that has an outline of what such legislation would look like that ensures that government can never do any of this again. Not just like, yeah, you know, cases are kind of low. It's no longer needed. No.
Yeah.
No, at this point, we have to make sure this is never revisited again.
Of course, you're right. I was pleased that the citizenry had to step up and do something about it, but they did. They pushed, and finally, the weak-willed Republicans actually took a little bit of action. But you're 100% right, Daniel Horowitz. Thanks for your time on this Friday. We appreciate it, sir.
God bless. Have a great weekend.
Now, more of Philadelphia's Morning Answer with Chris DeGaulle on AM 990 The Answer and 990theanswer.com.
Yeah, this story that I was just talking about before we spoke to Daniel from the Epoch Times, Tom Cotton told Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin yesterday that hundreds of military whistleblowers have reported being forced to receive anti-American indoctrination training, including critical race theory. This is everywhere all of a sudden, is it not? You're hearing about it everywhere. I warn you, I tell you, I'm saying it's not just school. It is in your church. It is coming to your church if it hasn't reached it yet. It is certainly infecting the military. And these leftists, once they get a bite of the apple, boy, they just keep going. In a Senate hearing with Austin yesterday, Tom Cotton, the senator from Arkansas, claimed that within the military, there's plummeting morale, growing mistrust between races and sexes where none existed just 6 months ago, and unexpected retirements and separations based on these trainings alone. One whistleblower, Cotton alleged, said that military history training was replaced with training about police brutality, systemic racism, and white privilege. Another said that his unit had to read White Fragility by feminist author and critical theory proponent Robin DiAngelo. In May, the Space Force confirmed it relieved Lieutenant Colonel Matthew Lohmer, a former instructor and fighter pilot, commander of the 11th Space Warning Squadron. While it didn't specifically name the reason why he was terminated, the Space Force cited comments made by him during a podcast in which he denounced critical race theory and warned about the spread of Marxism within the Space Force ranks. Critical race theory draws heavily upon Marxist critical theory, and postmodernist writers denounce U.S. and Western culture as oppressive, often claim American culture and institutions are promoting systemic racism and white supremacy. Critics have said the ideology's proponents apply the Marxist tactic of class struggle to divide people along lines of gender, race, and ethnicity rather than between the proletariat and the bourgeois. That is, the common man and the effete, the wealthy, the powerful. In the hearing, Austin told Cotton that some training is designed to make sure that the armed forces are welcoming to everyone who can qualify and who is fit to serve. Austin said, "We ought to look like the America we support and defend, and senior leadership should look like what's in the ranks." But Cotton suggested the claims the military is attempting to foster diversity with such training is incorrect. "It's about a very specific kind of anti-American indoctrination that is seeping into some parts of our military based on these whistleblower complaints we've received. The military for decades has been one of the institutions in society where you are most likely to get ahead based on your own performance, your own merit, introspective of your color of your skin, where you came from, or who your parents were." Austin agreed with Cotton's sentiment. "I absolutely agree with that. I'm an example of that." Yet, he's a proponent of the very thing that preaches against it. It's, folks, it's grotesque, and it's a fire hydrant, and it is in your school, it is in your church, it is in the military, it's certainly in cop training, it's probably in the corporation where you work. We're surrounded by it, and now is the time to get in its face and shove it right back in its face. Poke it in the chest, knock it to the floor. It's got to be stopped. Well, it was quite a day in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, finally. I mean, way too little, way too late, I know many of you feel, and I share that sentiment. But look, in this last year, I'll just take the wins wherever we can find wins. And the Republican legislature of Pennsylvania finally acted after the voters of Pennsylvania acted. And in mid-May, May 18th to be specific, the voters of Pennsylvania, by a thin margin, but they did anyway, passed an amendment to the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania's Constitution. And that amendment effectively said there will be no emergency dictates from a governor that will last beyond 3 weeks without our sign-off. So, said another way, this governor and every governor going forward will only get 3 weeks to declare an emergency and have total dominion over all things related to the state and things, business, and whatnot within it. And after that, the legislature either signs off on extending those terms or not. And by the way, that those questions 1 and 2 also amends the Constitution to say the legislature can step in and terminate the governor's orders at any time the legislature chooses. And so, you having voted yes in mid-May, if you're in Pennsylvania, the legislature, the Republicans, finally acted. And the House and the Senate yesterday passed a termination, an official termination of the governor of Pennsylvania's emergency orders related to COVID. So, a little bit of a silver lining. But down in Kentucky, an interesting fight continues. And with the Pacific Legal Foundation is one of their attorneys, Oliver Dunford. He joins us now to discuss it. Mr. Dunford, thanks for your time this morning. Hi.
Thanks so much for having me. Appreciate it.
Before the Kentucky Supreme Court is a similar, I guess, discussion. What we're really kind of vetting and trying to understand here as a civil society is just how far-reaching, how powerful are our state's governors?
Yeah, that's right. In Kentucky, like Pennsylvania, apparently, the governor had been allowed to declare a state of emergency and then issue orders for as long as he determined the emergency continued. And in February, the General Assembly in Kentucky passed some new laws over the governor's vetoes that limited all of his orders, at least certain orders under the emergency powers laws, to 30 days without the agreement of the General Assembly. But he continued, Governor Beshear in Kentucky, continued to enforce those orders, and so we filed a lawsuit against him.
So, Mr. Dunford, do you believe, given what you've seen here in Pennsylvania, for instance, as an example, our governor did the exact, I mean, it sounds like they've got the exact same dynamic in Kentucky. It took a constitutional amendment to get it done here. But we also have a Supreme Court that is stacked with Tom Wolf advocates. We also know that the Supreme Court in Pennsylvania was very active in redrawing congressional boundaries when that wasn't their purview, and they were very active in sanctioning election activities when that wasn't their purview. So we have a very activist Supreme Court. What's the situation in Kentucky?
Well, the Kentucky Supreme Court last fall issued an order that approved all of Governor Beshear's actions up to that point. But there's a question of how much activism they engaged in. The decision is defensible, I think. Some of the questions were close calls. But since the legislature's changed the law, the dynamics on the ground are a little bit different now. And hopefully the Supreme Court now will realize that the law has changed. And in the opinion last fall, they said the legislature can revoke or amend the governor's emergency powers. And hopefully they stick to that this time.
You're representing specifically in Kentucky, a brewing company. Is that right?
Yeah, a brewing company and two other restaurants.
And what is the basis for their claim, their grievance against the governor? I think we all understand it, but just in case somebody doesn't, what is it that the folks you're representing claim here?
Sure. The governor, among other orders, put some severe restrictions on restaurants and bars, including curfews at midnight, preventing service at the bar itself. In two instances, he shut down in-person service completely. And so, as I mentioned earlier, the laws limited the emergency orders to 30 days. So after the laws became effective, the orders that the governor had issued against restaurants lapsed 30 days later. And so at that point, we said they should be allowed to open, consistent with all the other laws in the Commonwealth. And we said that the violations amounted to constitutional violations. People in the Commonwealth are entitled to the protections provided by the separation of powers, where the governor executes the laws written by the General Assembly. The governor refused to follow those new laws. And so we believe that we have constitutional claims that prevented the restaurants from opening as they should have been allowed to.
I know the Pacific Legal Foundation does outstanding work, and you're loath to get into political commentary. So it sounds like we may have lost him. So let's try to get him back because I want to finish.
Hello?
A couple. Oh, we've got him. Have I got you?
I can hear you.
Dunford? Oh, sorry. Okay.
Yep.
I thought maybe we dropped for a minute. Apologize for that.
Yep, I'm here.
So what I wanted to ask you specifically was, I know you don't want to get into politics, so I'm going to try hard not to drag you into it, but it's hard to not notice that these issues keep coming up with Democrat governors, not Republican governors. And I think a lot of people would be surprised to know that this is going on in Kentucky, which is the home to people like Senator Mitch McConnell and Senator Rand Paul and a large swath of Republican voters. This does not seem to be an issue in traditionally Republican or red or conservative states. So it's Kentucky's not a state that's gotten a lot of attention, but it's interesting because it sounds very much like what's going on in the upper Midwest and the Northeast with a lot of traditional Democrat governors. Is that fair?
It's Dennis Prager on AM 990 The Answer. You're off to a smart start. Join me today at 1. Now here's Chris DeGaulle.
All right, we're back with Oliver Dunford. I think we made connection with him. Mr. Dunford, are you back?
I am back. Sorry about
okay.
that.
Okay. Nope, that's all right. It's pretty much grist for the mill if you knew the week we're having around here, but glad you're here and glad to get you back. He is an attorney at the Pacific Legal Foundation. He's representing a couple of companies and restaurants down in Kentucky against the governor. Andy Beshear is the guy's name. And I had a wind-up question for you, Mr. Dunford, related to the politics of Kentucky. I know Pacific Legal Foundation doesn't want to get into politics, but I just broadly, this sounds almost identical to what's going on in many northeastern blue states like Pennsylvania, like New York, like New Jersey, and the upper Midwest, like Michigan or maybe in Illinois. I don't think people associate this kind of stuff with Kentucky, that companies would be at odds with their governor and their legislature. You know, Kentucky's considered the South, and that's considered, Rand Paul, Mitch McConnell country. Do you have any insight into that?
Well, from what I understand, Governor Beshear was elected because the previous governor was pretty unpopular. And so Governor Beshear was elected, but the legislature remained solidly in control by the Republicans. And so Kentucky has a legislature that meets only for a short time each year. And so after, I think, April or so of last year, the General Assembly wasn't in session. And so the governor was allowed to exercise the emergency powers under the previous law. until January or February of this year, when the General Assembly came back into session, and they had a veto-proof majorities, and as I mentioned, over the governor's vetoes, passed these new laws. So it's pretty clear, it seems, from the elections last fall, where they added to the Republican majorities in the House and Senate, in the legislature, that they didn't like the micromanaging by Governor Beshear.
Yeah, and I have to say, Oliver Dunford at the Pacific Legal Foundation, again, I know you're not here to give political analysis, but you do deal with the judiciary and the judicial branch of our three-legged stool of this great experiment called the Republic. Have you found lately that legislatures seem sort of slow to act in this extraordinary time, while governors and executive branch seem to be just foot on the gas pedal? I mean, that's kind of my just general 30,000-foot view of everyone, not Kentucky per se. Your opinion?
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And I think some of that is in the nature of the different branches. The executive branch is the branch that is supposed to execute. You can see some of the founders, Hamilton especially, said that the executive must act with dispatch. But that doesn't mean that the legislature should you know, just sit back and let the governors do whatever they want. Their role is to set the policy. And
yeah,
the
like it's amazing. I'm sorry to interrupt you. It's amazing to me when I hear, because we heard it here in Pennsylvania. It's amazing when I hear legislatures say, "Well, we're not in session." Well, get in session then is my answer to that, right?
Well, in some, like Kentucky, for example, the legislature cannot call itself back into session. They have recently, legislatures have recently proposed a constitutional amendment to allow them to call themselves back into session. I don't know what the Pennsylvania Constitution says, but that was the issue in Kentucky. They're not allowed to call themselves into session.
I think COVID, has COVID done us, from a legal, purely just kind of a framework perspective, Mr. Dunford, do you think COVID's done us a favor and taught our legislative branch just how powerless in some cases they are in emergencies, long-term emergencies? They seem impotent, a lot of them, quite frankly.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And you see this at the federal level, too, that there's so much Congress is so willing to cede to the president. And I think you're right. The goal of the legislature should be to set the policy. The president should be executing the policy written by the legislature. That's the way it's supposed to work. And so maybe you're right. I hope you're right that one silver lining of COVID is that the legislature gets back to its proper role.
Oliver Dunford's an attorney at the Pacific Legal Foundation. As a legal matter, the Supreme Court so far, the United States Supreme Court, that is, seems pretty loath to get involved most of the time in issues like COVID and how states govern themselves, similarly with the election. Do you think that's got to change at some point, or do you think they're going to continue, as long as they have this particular makeup anyway, they're going to continue to just stay out of the way states govern themselves in cases like this that you're representing, for instance?
Well, in this case, our claims were based solely on the Kentucky Constitution, and in that case, the U.S. Supreme Court wouldn't get involved. They have gotten involved in cases involving the First Amendment, and some cases involve the federal 14th Amendment due process claims. But in those kinds of cases, generally, I think the U.S. Supreme Court will, for the most part, stay out of those cases. It's you know, the state Supreme Courts should be doing their jobs too, and that's not the role of the U.S. Supreme Court.
I think what's so scary to me is in Pennsylvania, again, I'm asking you to opine here maybe a little bit, and if you don't want to, you don't have to, certainly. But I to me, when you have an ideologically bent Supreme Court, as Pennsylvania does, that goes right along with the governor's every will, and then the legislature appeals to the Supreme Court of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, and the Supreme Court basically says, I like what the governor's doing, keep on keeping on. It's like the legislature's response is, well, we tried. I guess there's nothing we can do. There seems to be just no recourse. Like, what's the next step? If the United States Supreme Court can't do anything about it or won't, I guess you're just stuck. I guess that's why elections matter, is what you'd say.
I think that's right. I think elections matter, and I think if it becomes a problem, the legislature needs to keep writing new laws and, if necessary, propose constitutional amendments, perhaps. And, you know, I like litigating. Obviously, I'm a lawyer, but we realize that it's only part of the solution, that the a lot of it involves policymaking by the General Assembly, and a lot of it also involves persuading fellow citizens that the governor shouldn't have as much power as they've arrogated to themselves, and we need more balance in the governments.
As you guys look at this, I don't know how, I mean, I know you're specifically dealing with Kentucky, but at the Pacific Legal Foundation, I know cases like this have popped up around the country. Do you think the majority, it sounds like something like over half, I would say, 30 states or so, seem more hospitable to cases like yours and businesses that you're representing versus the rest that seem to have this very contentious relationship with the private sector, would you say? Would you say cases like yours are, how do I frame this? I always hate to bait you into a political question, but it's tough for me because I'm a political guy. Are cases like yours generally more favorable in red states than blue states and blue run states?
Yeah, I think so as a general matter. And I think as the pandemic has gone on, though we've gotten a little more support and, you know, perhaps some of that's exhaustion on the part of the public of all the restrictions. But I, as a general matter, I think that's true, that where we have a more conservative-leaning courts in the states, that our actions on these issues will be heard with, more sympathy.
As a legal matter, I guess I'll close with this. Can you see any reason legally at this point that a business would not be allowed to operate at this hour in any state of the union? Due to the virus, specifically as it relates to COVID, do you see anything on the ground that would warrant a governor continuing to keep edicts in place on a business in the way it operates at this hour in any state of the union?
Yeah, I mean, from a legal matter, I hate to say it, but probably yes. And it depends on what the laws say in the various states. But if the governors are given the discretion to make those calls, then unfortunately it probably is. I think at this point, like you say, I think the sympathies are on the other side to open things up. But the laws need to change. And you said earlier, and I agree, that hopefully that's one of the silver linings is that we'll see more action by the legislatures. But I think over the past year and a half or so, we haven't seen enough of that. And I hope that does change.
Boy, we're fortunate for organizations like the Pacific Legal Foundation and attorney Oliver Dunford, one of the attorneys there representing these companies in Kentucky. We'll watch your case. We'll root for you. I'm optimistic that you'll prevail, but we'll watch it and hope to have you back soon, sir. Thank you.
Great. Thanks so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Everything you need is waiting for you at 990theanswer.com.
You know, I really did not get to this week, and I don't know. I guess chalk it up to it doesn't surprise me. It always sort of elicits an eye roll because I'm not particularly interested in these radicals. But it never hurts to keep a sharp eye on what's going on out there with the squad and the hardest of hardcore left-wingers in the Democrat Party, because they seem to be increasingly the norm and they seem to increasingly have a seat at the table. And Democrats, as I've told you this week, seem to be starting to fracture out there. We're seeing it, I think, inside the White House with Kamala and Dr. Jill. I think we're starting to see it in polling when it comes to the border, specifically. That's why the disastrous trip by Kamala. I think we're seeing it with China and this virus and this lost year that we've lived through and the lies that are being uncovered. I think you're starting to see the Democrats crack up here. Their unity and their foot on the gas pedal salivating to conquer the country with their wacko ideas. I think it's too much too fast. And people like Ilhan Omar and the squad have come on strong. And to such a degree, Democrats are starting to hemorrhage. To the extent that Mark Goldfeder, who is the director of the National Jewish Advocacy Center, he wrote a piece in Newsweek, "Have the Democrats finally had it with Ilhan Omar?" I don't know if you paid attention to her this week. Like I said, I didn't really. I read it and kind of went, whatever. We got other things to talk about. But he says, Representative Ilhan Omar of the squad, she's a Democrat from Minnesota, just in case you don't know who she is. She's gotten quite good at shifting the Overton window for what is acceptable to say as a member of Congress. At this point, she has a well-established pattern. First, throw out something remarkably offensive, then let other liberals rush to her defense, thereby confirming they, too, are actually okay with what she said, before avoiding censure by finally offering a feeble or partial clarification or apology for having been misunderstood or having misspoken. It's a great trick. I mean, say something, he's exactly right to identify it, and he's smart to identify it. Say something outrageous and then gaslight everybody and say, oh, that's not what I said. That's not what I meant. You took that out of context. The cycle played out again this week. On Monday, Omar proudly sharing a tweet in which she implicitly equated the United States and Israel to the Taliban and Hamas, claiming they'd all committed unthinkable atrocities. By Wednesday of this week, a dozen of her Democrat colleagues in the House issued a statement condemning her comments as offensive and misguided, while the rest of her squad rushed to smear any Democrat who took offense and took offense at being compared to terrorists as racist and Islamophobic. Omar remained defiant, but then she clarified by yesterday morning, and she suddenly changed her tune and tried to distance herself from the original tweet. What is different this time, right, they note at Newsweek, is how the Democrat leadership reacted. It appears Omar's provocations may have finally gone too far for the establishment to ignore, and this is new. Over the years, she's had several close encounters with accountability. But this time, the entire leadership team of the Democrat Party issued a rare joint statement confirming they do not stand with Omar on this issue, that the United States and Israel are every bit as bad as the Taliban and Hamas, if that's the most amazing thing that it's come to this. But now the Democrats have been pushed to a point where they can't stand with her. In no uncertain terms, they wrote that drawing false equivalencies between democracies like the U.S. and Israel and groups like Hamas and the Taliban foments prejudice and undermines progress toward a future for peace and security for all. So he says the Democrats have finally taken a stand. Let's hope they keep doing so. They write at Newsweek. I'm not going to hold my breath. I think they know what disaster looms for them in 2022. They've pushed far too hard, far too fast. And I think the American public, slowly but surely, is waking up. Hope you have a great weekend. Back at it on Monday. Thanks for listening. ChrisStegall.com for the podcast. Email me. Stay in touch on social media.
This is WNTP, Philadelphia's AM 990. The Answer, a Salem Media Group station on the NASDAQ at SALM.